This week, the High Court dismissed a challenge brought by campaign group Rights Community Action to changes to permitted development rights and planning use classes that were implemented by the government as part of its response to the pandemic. In short, the three statutory instruments involved make it easier to build up, to demolish commercial premises and rebuild as residential, and to change the use of a property without needing planning permission. In the latest episode of On the Case, I am joined by Hannah Quarterman, partner and head of planning at Hogan Lovells International, to dig into the detail of the decision. Hannah, thanks for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
First, so can you outline for us in layman's terms what Rights Community Action's key concerns are over the three statutory instruments that we're concerned with?
So that's actually a really interesting question to start with, because their key concerns and what they were arguing in the case don't necessarily fully align. Their concerns, once you kind of dig down, seem to reflect those of many in the industry. The types of housing being delivered by PD Rights in particular isn't up to scratch, isn't the kind of quality that they wanted. They were worried about how homes being delivered pursuant to PD Rights were being used, whether affordable housing opportunities were being missed out on, and whether the most vulnerable in society were finding themselves effectively forced into substandard accommodation. However, laudable as those concerns may be, none of them give you a strict legal ground for judicial review. And so they had to frame these very differently. And so whilst it was clear what their underlying concerns were, the case itself was framed much more in terms of failure to follow due process and the government rushing through changes in response to a short-term problem without following all of the statutory procedures it was required to ensure appropriate protections.
That's right. And it effectively comes down to three main grounds that they were pursuing before the court. So what were those three main grounds of attack?
So, as I say, these get quite technical quite quickly. And so I'm not going to try and go into always the way of planning. Won't go into too much of the technical detail. But so the first one relates to carrying out an environmental impact assessment. And they argued that the requirements of the Environmental Assessment of Plans and Programmes Regulations 2004 means that there should have been an environmental impact assessment of the relevant statutory instruments because they constituted a plan or programme subject to these requirements. The second ground related to the public sector equality duty, and in particular they said that this duty, which applies to the actions of all public sector bodies when carrying out a range of different activities, hadn't been discharged when introducing the new legislation. The third ground was of itself made up of a multitude of mini grounds, which ultimately all related to whether the due process had been followed in terms of consultation. So within that third ground, they argued that the government had not conscientiously considered various responses made in respect of government consultations which have been carried out in the past, that they failed to take into account the government's own expert guidance when deciding to bring forward this legislation, that the government had failed to act consistently by not consulting again on various of these statutory instruments when it had consulted on a technical basis on other statutory instruments relating to things around phone masts, and finally that they'd failed to undertake further consultation even though they had promised to do so on one of the particular statutory instruments.
Okay, so taking those issues in turn, as the court did, why did the judges find that none of these statutory instruments ought to have been the subject of an environmental assessment before being made?
So the relevant European directive in domestic legislation sets out a number of specific criteria which have to be met before the relevant obligation kicks in. It was accepted that two of these apply, and those relate to the fact that the government had brought in the legislation, and that was fine. So we set those to one side. And so that left the final two to be argued over. Now, one of these is that the plan or programme must be likely to have a significant environmental effect. And there was an argument that the government hadn't given enough consideration to that and hadn't screened properly. And there might have been some scope there. But the issue was they didn't even kick into that particular criteria. They didn't get over the previous hurdle, which is that the plan or programme must set the framework for future development consents of projects. And what they try to argue in respect of the PD rights, they try to argue that because you have a whole process of prior approvals, other things, information you have to submit and things which need to be signed off by the relevant local planning authority, that they were effectively setting a framework for these future development consents. The court had no time for that. They said that it's very clear from law that the relevant statutory instrument grants the relevant permitted development right. It sets out conditions in a process which needs to be followed, but it is that statutory instrument which grants the right, and therefore it does not set this framework for future development consents. And they gave even shorter shrift in terms of the use classes order. They're very clear that use classes order, again, it's a tool which helps people establish whether or not planning permission is required. But what it doesn't do is set any framework for establishing whether development consent is required in the future. So in short, irrespective of whether there were likely to be significant environmental effects, because the relevant statutory instruments did not set this future framework, the relevant criteria weren't satisfied, and therefore they failed on this ground.
So that's ground one out of the way. What did the court have to say about the public sector equality duty ground?
So this one was an interesting one, and it was hard to perhaps not see the court as being slightly dismissive of this one. The court went through all of the various steps that the government had taken to discharge its public sector equality duty, including making the point that various of the consultation papers had specifically asked questions about this, had sought input on which vulnerable groups were likely to be affected above others. And they noted that very few people had actually responded on this. The relevant documents, when they came forward, made the point that the public sector equality duty was relevant and that the government had had regard to this. The government had also set out the fact that they recognised that there were certain vulnerable groups who could potentially be impacted upon by these decisions, i.e. the fact that in particular some of the permitted development rights around residential accommodation may result in residential accommodation which was less suitable for people with certain mobility issues or for the elderly, and that there was a general loss of affordable housing which could impact upon vulnerable groups more generally. The court took the view that the government had taken this into account, and they were very clear that what they felt was being challenged here wasn't in effect the process, but the outcome. The court was at pains to make it clear that it is not for the court or for anyone else to say what judgment the government should have come to. They were here to look at the process. And this was a theme that kind of runs through lots of the different grounds. It is not the court's job to say that the government reached the wrong decision, unless that's irrational. It's simply there to make sure that the government has followed the process that it was required to do so. And so in respect of the public sector equality duty, they very much found that they had.
Perhaps most interestingly in the judgment is how the court dealt with the third ground, the failure to consult ground. So why did they find that the Secretary of State had acted lawfully there?
So as I said before, this was broken down into lots of bits, and I think it's worth kind of picking through the different subgrounds to understand how what was presented as potentially multiple failings ultimately resulted in the decision being found to be lawful. So first of all, the argument that the government failed to conscientiously consider responses to the relevant consultation papers. And let's be frank, there were quite a number of consultation papers here. Well, the court again pointed to the fact that for each statutory instrument, there was an explanatory memorandum which summarised the outcomes of the relevant consultations and explained that, yes, there'd been some support and also some opposition. And in respect of the statutory instrument where they said that there was supposed to be more consultation, had flagged why they weren't carrying out more consultation. So again, the court decided that it simply wasn't arguable to say that they hadn't considered these responses. It was simply that they'd perhaps reached a decision based on the responses that others might not have done. Similarly, instead, in terms of the government's failure to take into account the views of its experts and the various expert reports which had been prepared, for example, a report which had recently come out around the quality of the types of homes which were being delivered by permitted development rights. Again, this got really short shrift. The court said that it's very clear that the government themselves had obviously commissioned these various reports, and they had indeed, when the reports were published, commented on the contents of these documents. Therefore, it wasn't really realistic to argue that they hadn't had regard to any of that material. And they found that it was simply unarguable to support that claim, and therefore that subground failed as well. The third one, as I say, relates to consistency. And the courts explained that in order for there to be a duty to consult, that has to either come from a statute or from a common law duty. But here, what the claimant was trying to argue is that because they'd consulted in a technical way on statutory instruments relating to permitted development rights for phone masts and the like, that meant that there had to be a similar technical consultation when it came to permitted development rights around homes. The courts highlighted that the claimant couldn't point to any law, any particular cases for that, and instead we're just trying to argue that it was kind of general fairness. But the government's position was that, well, each of these statutory instruments, every set of permitted development rights, needs to be looked at on its own facts. And what they did when deciding the extent of consultation required was to consider what the different impacts which need to be balanced, the different considerations they needed to take into account. And that's what dictated the level of consultation. And again, here, the court found that it was not irrational for the government to have decided that in this case, there was no need for there to be further consultation. Which leaves us with the final one, and the one where it felt like they might actually be onto something, that the claimant might have a chance of success. And this is the fact that the government had promised that there would be further consultation on one of the statutory instruments, the statutory instrument relating to demolition of buildings to be replaced by residential. And here it was accepted by all parties, and the government accepted that they had promised there would be a further consultation, and that this of itself could create a legitimate expectation. And when you have a legitimate expectation, then it's very kind of, the law recognises that the government or the relevant public body shouldn't resile from that unless there are good reasons for doing so. But that's exactly what the court found was the case here. It said that the pandemic and the impact of COVID-19 on the general economy, but in particular the construction industry, gave the government a very good reason to depart from that promise. There was a very good reason why they could resile from that legitimate expectation to carry out further consultation. But it's not good enough for there just to be a good reason. The court also had to consider whether it's proportionate to fail to carry out that consultation. And here the court recognised that the government, by failing to carry out the further consultation, had deprived itself of potentially helpful input into what the relevant statutory instrument should look like. But they weighed that against what they called a very grave economic situation and found that on balance, it was a proportionate course of action in the circumstances. And what's interesting, and which I think some people may take issue with, is the fact that the courts acknowledged that this particular permitted development right, the statutory instrument, does endure beyond the pandemic. This isn't a temporary right. So a temporary situation has been used to justify a departure from legitimate expectations in respect of something which could potentially continue forever. But that does not render the departure from this promise as being disproportionate. And they dismiss that ground as well.
So obviously the existence of this judicial review had caused a degree of uncertainty in the industry, with developers and local authorities having to base decisions on permitted development rights and use classes that might ultimately have been quashed. So it seems then that commentators have widely welcomed the certainty that this decision brings.
I think that is very fair. There had been some nervousness about people to start relying on these PD rights pending the outcome of this decision. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why this has been dealt with quite quickly in the whole scheme of how quickly cases go through the courts at the moment. But there is some comfort being brought from the outcome at this stage.
However, Rights Community Action has announced that it will pursue avenues for appeal. So do you think that still leaves the question mark over these reforms? And how would you weigh up the likely prospects of any appeal?
I think there is obviously still something of a question mark about this, given the appeal. However, the risk is viewed to have diminished significantly. The judgment here is quite robust. And as I've already mentioned, is it pains in a number of instances to stress that this, it is not the court's role to discuss the merits of the decision. They are simply interested in establishing whether the appropriate process has been followed. And they have found quite robustly that in every single case, despite the many, many different grounds being put forward, including the various subgrounds, the appropriate processes have been followed, notwithstanding the fact that other people may have reached different judgments based on the information provided, the consultation requirements. So I would say that on balance, if the appeal is brought, that actually it is unlikely to succeed. Obviously, there's still some risk, but I think people will feel emboldened to go forward now.
And of course, as we established at the outset, the case itself has to focus on available legal grounds of challenge. But that does still leave those concerns that are held by the group and about others about the types of development that can result from PDRs and a more flexible approach to change of use. So how do you feel that the new status quo that this decision has preserved will continue to operate in practice? And do you think further reform is needed to protect quality of development?
I think it's accepted by most now that there have been some poor quality homes brought forward pursuant to the permitted development rights, and that something needs to change. And I think it's interesting that the government itself started to acknowledge that, and that can be seen by the fact that there were already more stringent requirements being brought in respect of the quality of homes which has to be delivered. So we already have the requirements relating to demonstrating that there's adequate natural light for homes, which previously wasn't the case and was a direct response to some of the evidence which the claimant argued the government hadn't had regard to. There's also a new requirement which is being introduced in spring next year relating to the need to meet minimum space standards. So it is very clear that there needs to be a better quality of home being delivered pursuant to PDR. And it's also, I think it's fair to say that the government has recognised the arguments around the lost community that these PD rights can result in. So there have, you know, since their first introduction, people have been arguing not only that these new homes are able to be brought forward without contributing to affordable housing, but also, you know, they're not contributing to transport infrastructure or schools, all of these things, these homes which the homes would normally have to contribute to if they had secured planning permission, they get away scot-free, if you like. But again, that has been recognised in the planning white paper, and in there the planning white paper makes reference to a suggestion that the newly proposed infrastructure levy should apply to certain permitted development rights, including creating new homes. So it's clear that the government recognises that there is an issue. It just remains to be seen how exactly that kind of is addressed in the long term, and whether the current proposals, for example, using the planning white paper, leaves this too long. You know, the government have brought these in quickly because they want these rights to be used quickly. But given the likely timescale for getting any legislation in place as a result of the planning white paper, that still potentially leaves an awful lot of homes coming forward which aren't contributing to relevant infrastructure. And then on the flip side, you have the use classes order, which I think gives rise to very different challenges. And it's very early days in terms of understanding what the implications of the much broader Class E from the changes to these classes order are. So in terms of the permitted development rights, you have to remember that those have been around in one form or another for some time. So we've been able to see the issues that they've caused. But it doesn't take a great deal of imagination to foresee some issues arising from the increased flexibility, which again is something which people wanted and feels like an appropriate response to a short-term problem. You know, no one can walk down the high street and fail to recognise that there are real issues and that there needs to be flexibility. But I fear that there are bigger picture issues which also need to be addressed. So, for example, lots of local planning authorities have very clear policies around where it is appropriate to have retail floor space. the MPPF itself sets out, you know, the clear sequential approach to looking at where you should be putting your retail floor space. And then you'll have very separate policies around where office floor space should be going, where you want to have employment type hubs. And the introduction of this very large use class runs the risk of seriously undermining a lot of local authorities' strategic planning about what use is appropriate where in their individual areas. And in terms of determining planning applications, that can make their lives very difficult because they're determining against policies which were prepared against a very different backdrop. And so it will be interesting to see how local authorities kind of navigate their way around that. And there's a kind of a suspicion that one of the consequences of that is that local authorities may, when they start granting new permissions, find themselves actually limiting this flexibility. If they're granting permission for an office building in an area that they think is appropriate for office buildings, then all they need to do is impose a condition which then restricts that use. And so there is a real risk that actually the amount of flexibility that has been granted could end up having more restrictive planning permissions going forward, because it's the only way that local planning authorities can really control what's going on in their area. So there's this real risk that whilst this immense flexibility, which has been welcomed by many, has positive short-term implications, actually it could introduce a whole new range of uncertainty going forward about what the long-term use of property is likely to be.
Sounds like it could spark some conversations for another day there, Hannah. Yeah. So thank you very much for explaining this decision in such detail for us.
You're very, very welcome.
You have been listening to On the Case from EG.